This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 25th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Morris. Coming up today, we meet some of the local talent at the City of Toronto's biannual Fashion Week in Canada.
There's been a change in a number of different aspects of the event. Mainly in the first instance, it was all about the organisation and just elevating what were the production values for the designers, really looking at how we could go out across Canada and try and find more designers, not just the Toronto-based designers.
We head to an exhibition in Vienna that highlights the social aspect of architecture and urban planning.
We are in this exhibition and in this kind of work in general, overrepresented by Westerners. So I guess it is because we have enough, can use our time and our skills, and we can afford a plane ticket and we have a passport. My colleagues cannot because they have no identity. They're not legal, right, in any place.
And we speak to the men who are helping create an architectural vernacular that Australia can call its very own, more commonly referred to as the chook shed.
And to me, that idea of being able to just put in just enough and to put it in an adaptive way so that it can work for different seasons, different events, I think it's a fantastic approach to any architecture and certainly for housing.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Models strutted down the catwalks at David Picot Square in Toronto last week as the city hosted its latest and biggest IMG World MasterCard Fashion Week, celebrating Canadian designers from across the country. Spanning around 40 shows from Pink Tartan, Claxon Howell and Matthew Gallagher, this week-long affair started out 15 years ago when the Fashion Design Council of Canada decided to do something to raise the profile of the local fashion industry. 2 years ago, IMG, who's responsible for fashion weeks in New York, Miami and Mumbai, took over the reins. Monocle's Jason Lee spoke to IMG's global creative director, Jared Clark, to find out more.
This is our largest one ever, coming up to the 16th year of Fashion Week in Canada. We have over 30 designers presenting their collections. We have the two venues on site. We have some multiple shows happening off site. We have designers from right across the country that are presenting, and really from all demographics within the fashion industry. You know, you have that sort of designer fast fashion that's going on, and Joe Fresh does that so well. And he is a trailblazer, you know, and there's stores for that now down in New York. And really people are starting to know the Joe Fresh range outside of Canadian borders. And then you've got your really progressive designers. You've got your denim designers such as Triarchy, who really in a short space of time have created a great brand.
So why did IMG decide to take over Toronto Fashion Week 2 years ago?
Kind of, we actually had been working up here for a number of years. We were originally consulting to the FDCC and really looking at what they were doing and helping them to elevate their own event. Over time, it made a lot more sense through the business corporation that we had that potentially we looked to take the event off their hands and let them to really drive other initiatives for the industry. And we really saw so much talent here that we were really excited to have more ownership.
And how much has things changed since then?
There's been a change in a number of different aspects of the event. Mainly in the first instance, it was all about the organisation and just elevating what were the production values for the designers, really looking at how we could go out across Canada and try and find more designers, not just the Toronto-based designers. So we started a program called Mercedes-Benz Startup, and that was really about emerging designers and mentoring and seeing what we could be doing with them to help them to go to the next level in the business development. And we've also seen the amount of presentation opportunities evolve. So now we have two venues on site. One of them is fully flexible, so designers can do either a presentation for a smaller brand, but they can also do a very nice and intimate exclusive runway show. And we've really looked at how we can get our arms around what's going on in the city outside of the tents, so that Fashion Week really is a celebration of everything in Toronto and not just what's going on.
How do you keep things unique to a city and not just a generic IMG Fashion Week, you know what I mean? Is there such thing as a generic IMG Fashion Week?
No, it's very, very important that we continue to work with the local community. We're working with the local designers, we're working with the local PRs, we're working with the local fashion producers, we work with the local models. It's not about us bringing in people from outside the world, except when it's about trying to elevate experience levels. And we get some success in that by also bringing people from the markets here to other fashion weeks so they've got exposure to what goes on. But really, it's about making sure that it's a locally produced event for the local talent.
And how does Toronto Fashion Week stack up with the other fashion weeks around the world that you've done?
We're involved in a lot of fashion weeks around the world, and the unique part of Toronto is the fact that you do have this truly Canadian flavour, and Canadians have got a great sense of being proud of their own and really celebrating their own, and that's a wonderful thing for us to come and experience every season.
And how do you describe this Canadian flavor that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's a real mixed bag. You know, we've got designers from Vancouver, designers from Montreal, designers from Edmonton and Toronto all showing with us on a regular basis. And you see the different coasts have got a very different aesthetic. But you also see designers coming down from Montreal that have got this great avant-garde storytelling to what they're doing. And then you also have a nice, unpretentious, very, very chic but casual look on the streets of Toronto. So it really is quite diverse. And then your couturiers that you have with that wonderful red carpet season that goes on here. And I think inspired by the film festivals and all of the exclusive and more upmarket events that are going on here, there's a market for it.
Most people think, like if you ask anyone around the world and they think fashion and city, Toronto isn't the first city that comes into mind. Do you think that might change with IMG taking over the reins of Fashion Week?
Absolutely. Well, that's what we would like to change. We would like to be able to not just for people to think Toronto, we want people to be able to think about Canadian fashion. You know, it's very important for us that this is the national event. It is one of many fashion events within the cities around the country, but we want to be able to be the one that everyone comes to for the international platform. So everyone can work in their own backyards and they can grow their business and they can get their training wheels on. And then when they've got their product right, their pricing right, and their mix right, they can come and show here knowing they're going to get an international audience.
I'm just looking at fashion weeks in Canada. Why Toronto and why not Montreal, especially since Montreal, as you said, it's probably more avant-garde.
Absolutely, but that's just one part of the story. You know, here is industry. It's the international city of Canada. It's where a lot of your media are based. It's where a lot of your main retailers are based and the buying offices. And that's really important. It needs to be a touch point so the designers can do as much business as possible in that time.
And you're doing some stuff for like emerging designers. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's a very, very important part, not only to what we do as a business, but also as part of what Canada is about. You know, you've got these great students coming out of schools, not so sure what it is that they want to do next. So we want to make sure that we can help them through that process, you know, not to get lost in the weeds. So we have the startup program, which now is in its third year. We've been to provinces, including Calgary, we've been to Winnipeg, we've been to Vancouver, we've been to Montreal twice, we've been to Quebec City, we've been to Halifax, and we've been to Kitchener over the years, really going into the backyard of where the designers are. And so they can actually have contact with mentors and then eventually come and show it at World Mastercard Fashion Week here in Toronto.
Now, as Jason reports, an interesting component of Toronto Fashion Week is the Mercedes-Benz Startup Competition that helps emerging designers kickstart their careers. It's not a cash prize that contestants are after. It's a mentorship program where winners will get direct access to the who's who in the industry, including Jared Clark and editor-in-chief of fashion magazine Bernadette Mora. Jason caught up with the joint winners, Mallory Urbanovich from Edmonton, Alberta, and Montreal-based Cecily Raisonville from Matière Noire, just before they debuted their collections.
My name's Mallory Urbanovich.
Hi, I'm Cecily Raisonville, designer of Matière Noire. So I'm a fashion designer from Montreal. I was born in France. I studied in Barcelona. I did some internship in Paris and New York, and I finally decided to settle in Montreal because I think it's a great city.
Around 40 minutes to your first solo show. How are you feeling right now?
I feel really excited. We put a lot of work in preparing the show, and we are really so excited to show it to the public in Toronto. And
I'm feeling pretty numb. I feel like it's all going to set in about, you know, 15 minutes or so. I think everything's ready. We're just, waiting in anticipation. So I'm really excited.
I must say, I was kind of surprised. Everything looks kind of calm right now, so everything's settled. It could start in 5 minutes and it'd be ready.
Yeah, you know, well, I have a lot of help from Mercedes-Benz Startup, so they have everything so organized. You know, we have the show producer and all of the assistants backstage, so everything is really taken care of well, and we're just here to wait and hope everything goes smoothly. It's really about the fabric. All of the textures are really soft and luxurious. It's inspired by Canadian winters, so everything's really comfortable and cozy, and the colors are really surprising for winter.
What are you inspired by? You've lived in many different cities. Does all that come into play?
Yeah, of course. I think I feed off that. For example, this collection is inspired by the Inuit motifs. We did some belts that are hand embroidered with this inspiration.
So you're very much embracing the Canadianness of your experience here.
Yeah. I try to collaborate with people here, some artisans, and I'm also in a team of three people. I'm not able to do everything on myself, so I work with Alice Chipot and Olfa Kennessy, which are my team, yeah.
Working in Canada, is it very different from working in Barcelona?
I think there is still a lot to do here. People are really interested in fashion. It's really a growing field, so it's really exciting, yeah.
You're doing your makeup. Is that all that's left now before the show, or do you have a lot to do?
No, it's unfortunately I have my team that is helping, so yeah, we are ready, yeah.
What's your biggest fear, your first solo show?
I guess I would be afraid that all the clothes got ruined somehow, or a fire. There was actually a fire alarm that went off at our hotel, and I said that I was gonna, if the hotel was burning down, I'm burning down with it, so.
Well, best of luck, and I'll speak to you after your show.
The runway show kicks off with Cécile's collection for Matière Noire. Her fashion label means dark matter in French. There's a futuristic outer space sensation to her clothes. After all, her parents work for the French Space Agency. Her modern pieces blend masculine and feminine elements in dark shades, lots of electric blues and blacks. Inuit tattoos made from woven leather pay homage to her new home here in Canada. The motifs adorn, but not overwhelm, her collection. Mallory's collection is more consumer-facing, inspired by Albertan winters, and is all about fabric choice. The color palette is lighter, featuring sky blues, creams, and mossy greens. Her clothes, mostly knitwear, look warm and comfy, but the models strutting down the catwalk still evoke a sense of lightness. Mallory's impeccable draping of the various luscious wools she's chosen takes center stage. I caught up with the designers after the show to find out what their plans are now that they're all properly started up.
So how do you feel now?
I feel wonderful. I feel like the response was really great. And, it's always really nerve-wracking when you see everything go backstage off into where everyone can see it. So yeah, I feel like everyone really liked it. And so I'm super happy, very relieved.
And now that you're all started up, what next?
I've already started thinking about my next collection, trying to, nail down a spot here again at World Master of Card Fashion Week so I can show another collection and hopefully wow people again.
Moving forward, how are you going to consolidate your brand getting off the success of this one?
I think we are taking it slowly. The most important is obviously to expand our point of sale, so we look forward to meet with buyers and distribute the brand throughout Canada, so that's the second step, yeah.
And what's your dream and vision for your own brand?
I want to create an universe, keeping collaborating in Quebec and everywhere else with artists, and I want to create a really inspiring brand, that's the goal.
And amidst the sea of fashion weeks around the world, one of the mentors from the startup competition, an editor of fashion magazine in Toronto, Bernadette Mora, told Monocle's Emma Nelson and Ted Kravitz why Toronto's was different.
Toronto Fashion Week actually started more than a decade ago, but it was more of a sort of a independent event that was organized by something called the Fashion Design Council of Canada, which sort of would be comparable to, I guess, the British Fashion Council, but on a much, much smaller scale. In 2012, IMG, the big worldwide sports and entertainment conglomerate, bought Toronto Fashion Week. Mm. So that brought a lot of sponsorship dollars and a sort of a new level of professionalism to the event. So Toronto Fashion Week has been around for quite a long time, but it's sort of become more polished, I would say, in more recent years.
In what way has it become polished? Because it was, you've painted a picture of a very edgy and independent-minded fashion show, and sometimes to have too much polish can take the fun away.
Well, that's true, but Toronto designers are pretty much like starving artists. So they need as much support as they can get. So if it means bringing in lots of sponsorship dollars and people throwing makeup samples at you as you walk through the door, who cares? You know, as long as there's something that is supporting Canadian designers, they desperately, desperately need it. Now, that being said, there is also sort of a splinter fashion, not week, but there are other fashion events that take place the week prior to this week. And so not all of the, I would say, top designers locally are participating in the official Toronto Fashion Week. And that's one big distinction between London, Paris, Milan. I mean, aside from Azzedine Alaïa in Paris, he would, you know, who shows according to his own schedule, all of the top designers in those fashion capitals are showing at the official Fashion Weeks.
So that, with that in mind then, Bernadette, tell us what are the eagerly expected and awaited and attended shows going to be?
Well, the bigger name shows actually are happening right now, and I am not at them. That would be...
sorry, would that be our fault?
No, that's okay. They're there. Our team's there. Joe Fresh, who is a, I wouldn't say a designer brand, but is a sort of a Primark kind of a brand that is sold in Loblaws grocery stores and which has just announced an expansion to, I think it's 25 countries globally, or I can't remember the exact number, but just is about to explode. It's very low priced, very well priced fashion, but very high design, so great value for money. That oddly, not oddly, but I mean, where the big shows in Paris, say, are the really expensive clothes, the big ticket in Toronto is Joe Fresh. And that has a lot to do with how socially known Joe Mimran, the designer, and his wife, Kim Newport Mimran, are. So they are a very sort of high status couple about town. And they have a lot of high-powered social friends, and that's the big ticket. And Pink Tartan, Joe's wife, Kim, designs a label called Pink Tartan, which is very popular. And it's sort of a, I would say, like a Tory Burch kind of a collection, in, you know, for lack of better comparison. And she shows right before him. So it's sort of the Kim and Joe night. That's tonight, and that is the big night of Toronto Fashion Week.
How does that, therefore, make the other shows carve their own niche out? Because if you have such an unusual big ticket, then surely that must rub off on the way that the other shows show.
You're quite right. It does. But in another way, though, it's sort of, it has a bit of a halo effect. So Joe and Kim get so much publicity for what they do that it gives a certain aura to the event as a whole. So then the struggling indie designers who are scraping together their pennies to show on the catwalk do sort of benefit from all of the cameras and all of the eyeballs that are coming to Toronto Fashion Week in general.
Bernadette Moore of Fashion Magazine. Coming up, we head back to Europe to visit an architecture symposium in Vienna.
A new generation of stationery entrepreneurs are reviving the art of letter writing. Monocle Films travels to Prague, Vancouver, and London to visit three stationery shops who share a love of paper.
I was always fascinated by the fact, like, how many different forms the simple piece of paper can have. I like the space that opens up when you unfold a simple piece of paper or when you open the notebook, and no email can ever replace the feeling when you open your mailbox and you find the letter there.
A celluloid celebration of old-school stationery shops, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Can architects make the world not only more beautiful, but also a more just place? If yes, then how? These and other questions were at the focus of an international symposium held in Vienna earlier this month to mark the opening of an exhibition highlighting the social aspect of architecture and urban planning. The all-day event brought together some of the world's most socially aware artists, designers and planners, working to tackle issues which architecture today finds increasingly difficult to ignore, such as global conflicts and wealth disparity. Our man in Austria, Alexei Korolyov, went along for Monocle.
We have to be aware that being an architect, you have to take your responsibility.
Oder auch zum Beispiel die Stadt Shibam in Jemen, ein wunderbares Beispiel.
When we are architect, we have to think what we have and we have to fix the objective.
Architecture and design have always been at the service of society. But only now, it seems, their social relevance is being genuinely addressed.
What we've seen today is that architects from all over the world are sharing a common goal of doing something which is benefiting the communities again.
Global overpopulation, environmental degradation, and political conflicts have all given a new dimension to the profession. So says Anne-Lynn Gore, the editor of the German architecture magazine Arch Plus and moderator of the symposium hosted by Vienna's Architekturzentrum.
Architecture is the outcome. Architects are going into the communities to initiate processes. And in the end, we have materialized outcome, which is called architecture. But the most important thing is the exchange of knowledge, of cultural learning.
The event, ambitiously called Architectures for a Better World, follows the first such conference held in Frankfurt last year.
Creative source that the natural materials, like taking earth, for example, is...
Anna Heringer, a German earth architect and designer, was among the speakers in Vienna.
For me, the main challenge as an architect, and also, you know, the coming generations of architects, is that how to build homes for 7 billion people in a way that we support the justice in our society, that we don't exploit our natural resources, and also how to, in a way that fosters a cultural diversity.
Heringer's recent projects include a school in Bangladesh made of earth and bamboo and a thatched kindergarten in Zimbabwe. She says this experience has convinced her that a radical rethink of architectural training is in order.
But also in architectural education, we really should focus also not just on digital skills, but also really to bring in manual skills again and craftsmanship, because you design differently when you have an understanding of materials and construction. And I think we should really find the beauty in the most ordinary things on site, and we should also embrace the vulnerability of natural materials. This is something that embodies a harmony with the society there, because a lot of people, a lot of labor is involved, and I think that gives some strength and authenticity that is often lacking in contemporary architecture, and I think we should really focus on the authenticity of it.
It is this sentiment, as well as perhaps a touch of sentimentality, that prompted the Norwegian architect Line Ramstad to stay on in a small village on the border of Thailand and Burma after she'd done planned construction work there.
After 5-6 months, when the buildings were finished, I felt like, no, I cannot leave this place. This is when it starts. This is when I start to understand the culture. This is when I start to understand the life here. This is when I start to really understand what the people around me are saying, not at least. So I met fantastic people that I still work with today, and together we founded Goyo Goyo, and that is Kren and means slowly, step by step. And now for 6 years we've been building houses, community buildings basically, for and with the local population on the border.
Some questions remain, however. Why is this thinking only just emerging today, for instance? I asked another symposium speaker, Andres Bepler Ramirez, a Colombian-German architect specializing in bamboo buildings.
The architecture in the world is walking in steps, yes? And what I see is that now we are losing more and more the orientation. The people are not in the center of a development. It's more the facade, to be clean. Look at the cars. From my view, each car looks like the other. we are missing identification. And so I think here are a lot of people who saw this the last 10 years. They began to act.
That's all well and good, but what really stimulates them? A question for Anna Heringer and Lina Ramstad.
I think we're probably also a bit tired because, I mean, we've done everything. I mean, you can find any kind of crazy shapes already, and our architectural magazines are full of we architects are also often seen as the ignorant genius that just wants to impose things on others. We have so many jobless architects looking for something meaningful to do, and I think this is kind of a crisis, which is a fertile soil, I would say, for this kind of architecture, because everyone wants to be needed.
We are in this exhibition and in this kind of work in general overrepresented by Westerners. So I guess it is because we have enough. We have full stomachs. We can use our time and our skills, and we can afford a plane ticket and we have a passport. My colleagues cannot because they have no identity. They're not legal, right, in any place. You know, and they also don't have the access to the knowledge of the rest of the world that we have.
Examples of social engagement in architecture are still few and far between. But the hope expressed at the symposium is that we'll be seeing more and more of them in the years to come, as more and more people around the world are discovering their social responsibility. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Now, in a few weeks' time, the design world will descend on Milan for the year's biggest event, Salone del Mobile. The Furniture Fair is a showcase for Italy's established design brands and emerging talent. One who knows both worlds quite well is Marco Vallardi. The enterprising 31-year-old Italian is creative director at one of the country's respected furniture companies, De Padova. Since 2011, he has looked to freshen up the firm's portfolio of classic pieces from the likes of Vigo Magistretti with new ideas. Vallardi sat down with Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, to talk about the challenges of leading a historic design brand and the prospects for Italy's furniture industry as it gets set to host Salone and looks to stay one step ahead of the competition.
I think it was a very brave decision from De Padova to appoint somebody this young, although I don't maybe feel as young as people imagine. But I think it was an interesting point of trying to sort of change the establishment and the way the Italian establishment, especially in the design world, works. In the beginning, I don't think it was the easiest, neither for me or the company, because it's easy to choose the big names and go on the safe options. But in the long run, I think after 3 years that we've been working together, I think you can see some of the results, and some people now understand there is a possibility to engage with younger professionals and eventually try to do things in a different way.
So when you took on your role as creative director of Padova, what was your approach to this traditional design brand?
My approach was very straightforward. I basically looked into the heritage of the company, trying to understand why and how it started and why Maddalena started such a shop and then company, of course. So I looked back at the Scandinavian roots and where she began by buying and reselling these pieces, and how she also began to produce like furniture and original pieces with Italian designers, and how she put together the whole ambience that we know as the De Padova, you know, feeling the De Padova lifestyle today. So what I did, it was like cleaning up the layers that I accumulated over the years. And I didn't want to revolutionize. I didn't want to like go crazy and put so many designers, so many new pieces and change. I think that, you know, the brand is there and the brand is very strong. And what needed, it needed to shine again. And by cleaning up, you know, from the collection to the communication, to the shop appearances, the windows, that's how I try to sort of put it back into place for the context of the future.
Is it a challenge with a brand like this, with a Scandinavian influence, let's say, but a made in Italy brand, to communicate that to customers, especially maybe new customers who don't know the De Padova story?
It is definitely a challenge, but it's an interesting challenge in the sense that we are almost like a small boutique brand, and we also shop, so we have this double background. I think that you can still appeal to those customers and to new markets if you do it smartly. You don't necessarily need to do like go for the safety blanket of just putting some gold here and there and some like special skins of leather or whatever. I think it's about trying to explain your core values and try to do, of course, like, you know, what some of the markets require, but you don't need to change your brand or try to change your look, you know. You can still be appealing. And I think the Padova is still very appealing.
Do you see that today, that some design brands are looking for the outdoor market to attract clients from the Emirates or India or Brazil, say, or perhaps going after Russian clients with new money?
I think a lot of brands are doing that. And I think that Depardo is always, of course, interested in new markets. You know, if you look at the economy outlook of Italy, it's very scary. At the same time, I think we can go after new markets in a way that is like our way. We don't need to just follow route. Also, I think the lack of Depardo is that they didn't overdevelop over the last 10, 15 years. And in a way, they're still fresh to this game. And eventually they can do it their own way. And somehow you might see it as a, you know, not good position to be. I think it's an excellent position to be, because what people are looking nowadays is these small niche brands, and these brands are doing it their own way and they show their character.
Now, besides the new collection you're presenting at Salone, you're also having a Fori Salone event, Source Material. Just talk a bit about that exhibition that's going on during the fair.
Source Material is a project that was initiated by Jasper Morrison, Jonathan Olivares, and me. We basically came together a few months ago with the idea to try to do something that was close to our interests and close to what we felt Salone was missing. As I mentioned, I think Salone is a meeting of ideas, and what we're trying to bring here, it's that source material for ideas, that inspiration point, what like people like consider their objects, their references, their keepsakes, and what, you know, gives them the go ahead and produce projects and, you know, and be creative. Let's put it this way. Maybe it sounds cheesy. So Source Material, I brought together around 50 participants from the likes of David Chipperfield, Naoto Fukasawa, Michael Maharam, and there's a few other, you know, that you could discover by coming to see the exhibition.
What do you see as some of the challenges facing Italy's furniture industry today?
Well, I think that the challenges are various, and you know, the main challenge is stay competitive. You know, what the businesses are looking at is like stay on top of their game, not just on a creative level, but competitive from the production side. So production and sales. So I think that some of the companies that we have today should not just look for outside producer, but to stay competitive and to be strong in what they are. They should work with the suppliers they have here. I mean, some of the things you do is partner with them or try to create a sort of tight bond that eventually will not just be for the next day or for the next week or next month or the next Salone. Is about like the long term, and that longevity is what's going to come back and be the success. I think there is definitely a shortage. There is definitely like less hands than brains that we have today. There's more people trying to tell you what you should do and how to save Italy rather than hands that are going to save Italy. And I think what companies need to do is to create schemes that eventually brings in, like, and not just companies, through the state. I mean, bring people back into actually manufacturing and producing, and not just on an artisan craft level, because that's a touristic thing. That's to tell people made in Italy crafts. It's about an industry that is still going smaller and smaller and smaller, and we need to put it back into place. But in the end, that's the tissue of our sort of industry in a way. And I think that we need incentives from both the state and from the companies to invest into those businesses. As I say, those are where our competitive edge stays and remains. And now we're calling them craftsmen, artisans, but in a way, that's the industry. That's the base of what we need. And I think that the more we call craftsmen and artisans, the more we're going to lose them, and you know, more and more. The skills are artisanal skills, but we still need to keep them in an industry level to be able to compete.
Marco Velardi of De Padova speaking to Ivan Cavallo in Milan. Don't forget, Section D will be at Milan during Salone del Mobile to report on our pick of the thousands of designers and new works on display. After the break, we'll hear from the slightly unconventional winners of the Australian Architecture Awards, Troppo.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's the curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Last year, we reported on the world's so-called first quiet house, made by Quiet Mark, a British charitable foundation that fights unnecessary noise. This year, Quiet Mark went one step further and revealed the first quiet treehouse at this year's Ideal Home Show at London Earls Court. The treehouse has been designed by Blue Forest Luxury Treehouses. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, spoke to Simon Payne, the director of Blue Forest, and with Poppy Elliott, managing director of Quiet Mark. But before that, he had his audio portrait taken by a quiet orchestra called Epiphany, who's also at the treehouse for a special performance.
This company was started by my brother Andy Payne, and we work together, so it's a family business.
It's an interesting thing that you work with treehouses, because it seems to me that they're so popular now. Do you think it's because the world is getting like busier and busier and faster, and people want some kind of idyllic treehouse in the middle of nowhere, let's say?
Yeah, I think treehouses definitely. Obviously, it's a bit of a niche business. If you mention to someone that you build treehouses for a living, I think they think of a couple of sort of pallets of wood up in a tree. But actually, you know, the treehouses that we build are much more elaborate and functional and useful than that. But they do, it's all about the imagination and creativity and the things that you think back to when perhaps you were a child and you played in a treehouse. So I think for people, it's the escape from the busyness of life and from all the different things that are thrown at us in our day-to-day, in our business, in our family, and just to have somewhere like a sort of, I guess historically it might have been a cave, or you know, somewhere you retreat to, and that can just be a hideaway. So I think that's part of the kind of importance of this type of structure for people. But and more than that, I think it's fun. You know, people just enjoy the fun. It's really nice to do something that's not just, you know, a rectangular building and you kind of clear the trees and the plants away, but you have the opportunity to do something that's built into the natural features, into the tree, and just to do something fun. So I think our clients are often just people that really want to experiment and just see what might be possible.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the treehouse we are at the moment? Yeah. It's tell us a bit more about the partnership with Quiet Mark. And, well, I have to say it's wonderful. I want one for myself, Simon, if that's okay.
That's brilliant. We were really excited. And back in October 2013, Poppy Elliott, who's the MD from Quiet Mark, approached us. And she had the idea to develop a quiet treehouse where we would really engineer the building to make sure that when you closed all the doors and windows, it was just a quiet haven and a retreat where you could have sort of technology in harmony with nature. So we came up with a concept for the design, and we, in association partnership with Quiet Mark and John Lewis and the other key sponsors, because there's so many people involved that have made the project worthwhile and kind of successful, we came together with the design and amazingly have managed to bring all of that to this point where we're sitting in a structure in the space of just a few months, and we had 6 days to build it here. But yeah, really, from Quiet Mark's sort of input into the project has been really exciting, because for us, our clients, as we've sort of talked about, are excited by the idea of a hideaway and a retreat and the quietness of life. But to find an organization like Quiet Mark that are really experienced at looking into how technology and these different things impact in our lives, it's just a perfect combination.
That's what I was going to say, because I believe if someone wants a treehouse, I mean, one of the main things is like peace and tranquility, right? So I think this idea that you can have an even quieter treehouse, it makes very much sense.
Yeah, it makes a huge amount of sense. And I think just to understand more about sound and how sound impacts, because actually if something's completely silent and there's no sound, it's a sort of solitary confinement, it's actually not good for us. So it's not about taking out all of the sound, it's about taking out the unwanted sound. And I think it's the same with the technology products that are on show in the Quiet Treehouse here. You know, they're all useful things, and we like our creature comforts. So even for our clients, when we build treehouses, they like the idea of getting away from life, being closer to nature, but they don't want to be without the things that they like, their creature comforts, if you will. So to see how technology is advancing and we're able to introduce all these amazing products into the treehouse that can kind of enhance the actual function of the building and make it somewhere where people can spend time for a prolonged period, perhaps even live, or maybe if it's a hotel or something like that to stay in, then that's really interesting.
And if I may ask finally, which kind of material did you use in this house specifically that you didn't, for example, in the other ones?
So this particular treehouse, as with all of ours, is built to be as sustainable as possible. So one of the really exciting materials is called kebony. All the exterior of the building is lined in kebony, and it's a sustainable alternative to tropical hardwood, but extremely durable and dense, so it has good acoustic properties. And then within the actual wall structure, we've got rock wall, which is a thermal insulation but also has great acoustic properties. And then a key is something called AcoustiBlock, which is a rubber membrane, and that completely wraps the building like an envelope, and it blocks out as much sound as lead, really, a kind of equivalent. So a really very effective product. And what that means is that overall, in a kind of a little soundbite, this building is about twice as quiet as your average house. So you walk inside, in fact, it's a little bit like being in a concrete box that's 30 centimeter thick walls. You know, it's that soundproof. So yeah, it's been a real interesting design challenge to look at how we can do that, include those products within the actual envelope or makeup of the structure, but then also in a way that we can build it at a show and put it up very quickly and keep it as sustainable as possible.
I'm Poppy Elliott, and I'm the founder and managing director of Quiet Mark, which is the new mark of awards from the Noise Abatement Society. We wanted to take the idea of technology being in absolutely immersed in nature, or how technology can become more compatible with a very, very natural environment. So like the ultimate dream pad is going right out there, away from the crazy urban pace and lifestyle, to a treehouse of your own where you can retreat from the world, be cocooned in the most beautiful soundscape of nature. But we chose the Ideal Home Show to do that because it's the noisiest, craziest place to do it, to prove our point in terms of sound insulation. And so we partnered with John Lewis. This is the launch of our partnership with them to bring sound quality to consumers in the high street and online for all the awarded Quiet Mark products. So we've got a showcase here within the treehouse, which is kind of away from the world, built by Blue Forest Treehouses.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco reporting there. In a profession where the big gongs generally go to designers of the Look At Me glamour city buildings, an unlikely duo has this week been awarded Australia's highest architectural honour. Troppo architects Adrian Welk and Phil Harris have built a national and international practice while keeping their design simple. As simple as the Aussie tin shed. That was what inspired them 30 years ago when they started their practice in Darwin, where Troppo is local parlance for going mad in the heat. They're anti-air conditioning and make as much use as possible of sun, wind and the local landscape in their lightweight structures. Their designs have occasionally been dismissed as chook sheds and ghettos, but they are now being seen as fashionably sustainable and a model for developing a distinctive Australian architectural style. Welk and Harris believe their Keep It Simple manifesto works anywhere and in any climate, as they told Annie Hastwell after the awards ceremony in Hobart last week.
The 2014 Australian Institute of Architects Gold Medal is awarded to Adrian Welke and Phil Harris of Troppo.
It was a big moment for two architects who were almost denied entry to their profession 3 decades ago because of the odd name they'd chosen for their new business. As Troppo's Adrian Welke reminded the Australian Institute of Architects in Hobart last week.
The application was taken to Crown Law as to how they could get it knocked off because they deemed it to be bringing the practice of architecture into disrepute.
Troppo Architects did manage to get registered in Darwin in 1980 and quickly became known for a very open and minimal style of building. Phil Harris says they were inspired by the bush architecture they'd seen while travelling around Australia.
The amazing thing is that these were really abstract plans, these houses. They were really simple, interrelated spaces inside, which I guess enabled the breezes to move across them. In hot, humid climates, you achieve comfort by having air movement over your skin, and you want to have good, dark spaces inside. So how do you achieve that? Well, solid material. So these buildings had whole walls that opened up. So there's no sense of wall and window. The whole wall would work to promote breeze and create a darkish space inside where you felt a lot more comfortable than out in the glare of the day.
What kind of reaction did you get in the early days? Because you have maintained a certain edgy place in the architectural landscape in Australia.
Well, the early days, there was a reaction. It was a very divided community in Darwin that viewed the early work. Those people that had some knowledge or understanding of what pre-cyclone Darwin was, or certainly had been somewhere around the world in tropical environments, so could understand what these buildings exuded. But there was the other part of the population who really could not see the potential for them to live in it, in fact, hated it, and it really did divide and create a significant debate, which we rode the crest of.
Well, I guess people who are from the temperate south, and as Adrian was saying, are likely to be recently arrived in Darwin, couldn't see that our houses were really houses. Perhaps they, in their mind, were more sheds or something that might sit down in the back of the yard to accommodate chooks. Because unless you have a neat window and a neat wall with somewhere to draw curtains across, it's perhaps not a house.
How have you taken those kind of early principles, though, and moved them, because your work spreads across Australia and indeed internationally now, how do you use those principles in completely different climates? Are you able to stay as simple as you started?
Those early buildings were really simple, honest, I'll use the word crude, buildings, very affordable. A lot of our work is probably not at that end of the spectrum anymore, but that doesn't negate the possibilities of still doing that, and we still do it in very simple, small buildings.
We did think about our architecture early on in this way, and it's the way the Japanese build, which is a post and beam construction, and then you just add the layers you need, the layers for privacy, the layers to control the weather, and those interesting layers which enable you to conjoin spaces, i.e. remove walls to make spaces bigger. And to me, that idea of being able to just put in just enough and to put it in an adaptive way so that it can work for different seasons, different events, I think is a fantastic approach to any architecture and certainly for housing.
It's about understanding where you are, the place in which you're working, and that means understanding the climate, and that's where the sun is, where the breezes come from and go to, and the landscape generally that's created by that climate. The tropics is probably an extreme environment where we react in very obvious ways with our building detailing, but the same happens in temperate climates where you need to understand where you are.
Yeah, so up north it's all about getting rid of the heat through the day, through the night. So buildings are made of very thin walls that give up their heat quickly. Down south in a more temperate climate, or in the centre of Australia, the high arid climate, where the nights are significantly cooler than the days, you want to be able to store any heat through the day. In winter at least, you want to store to give up again at night time to maintain an even balance. But from winter to summer, it's obviously a different dynamic. In winter, the sun's your friend. In summer, it's not. So you need to shade with eaves at just the right lengths. But dynamic devices, the day spans from morning to evening and the sun angles are lower morning and evening, so often you still need shutters and blinds to work with the day that is.
Where is Australia up to in terms of developing its own real style?
I think Australia has moved a long way, and even to go back as far as when the early colonial experience was just adopting techniques and building styles and solutions from where the population of people had moved from. But over the 200 or more years now, there is a growing understanding of who we are, and particularly in the way the landscape and the way in which we engage with that landscape.
And the thing about this, I believe, is it produces what I would call an architecture of great informality. It's not about, here is my front door, look how beautiful it is. It's not ostentatious. And the materials that it's chosen to use are often just so humble. You'll find them in the back sheds of homesteads, of farmhouses. For example, corrugated iron, timber used as weatherboards or timber slats, as floors, as decking, and just local stone, the stone from that site, avoiding applied finishes. So these buildings actually age gracefully, just like all of us gather a few wrinkles and sags and our pallor goes. But we're kind of nice people still, you know.
Harris and Wilkie say they'll use their new gold medalist status to lobby for change to current building codes, which they say encourage concrete bunker-style housing at the expense of the environment.
The current code, the energy efficiency measures that are included in the construction code, have a lowest common denominator presumption, which is we're going to use air conditioning. And so it will be sealed up and insulated, quite contrary to the way in which these early buildings had no walls and no insulation.
It seems rather quizzical that we have a code that decides that air conditioning is the best way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Sure, they're energy efficient boxes, they're sealed and work really well for lowering that energy demand from the air conditioners, but surely the ultimate is to devise buildings that need no air conditioning at all, which is where we started from and where we continue to go in our pursuit of appropriate architecture for Australia.
For Monocle at the Australian Architecture Awards, I'm Annie Hestwell.
That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to our producer, Aled John, and Holly Fisher for her studio production. Should you feel the need, you can contact the producer, Aled, at awj@monocle.com. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out this week, following on from Toronto Fashion Week, is a Canadian that never goes out of style, Katie Lang with Constant Craving. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.